It's a pleasure to be here, and it's an honor to be here to give this fourth Patrick Memorial Lecture. Bill was a very good friend of mine, a mentor. I miss him dearly, as I know his dear wife does. Used to talk to him about every month about a number of issues, and I decided to talk about phosphorus biogeochemistry today. And as the title states, the state of our understanding, I probably should have listed it as the state of my understanding, which is much more limited than it probably should be. For those who didn't know Bill, I want to show a picture of, this is taken in Belgium actually, of Bill and Ruth, who we're delighted to have in the front here. If you haven't met her, you should meet her afterwards. She's a delightful lady and a great scientist in her own right and well-distinguished career. But Bill and Ruth and my wife and I were on a trip in Belgium. There's a little nostalgia there. So that was right here in the Phragmites. So I have some lofty goals today. I got into this. I've been actually working on a longer piece, a monograph, that I seem to never be able to finish as we get more into the literature. But I wanted to basically try to figure out what we could start with, and I got really interested in this topic, so it's going to be a much different kind of lecture. It's going to be a little broader, and then I'll focus back down on wetlands. So I'm going to talk about what's the global status and future of phosphorus as it relates to sort of agriculture and wetlands, and ask some questions like, where does phosphorus come from and how much do we have left, which maybe seems like a strange way to start. And then sort of what's sort of new on the horizon, which you'll see will relate to some of the wetlands issues we're talking about. Understanding phosphorus biogeochemistry in the environment. Then sort of what is our understanding of phosphorus biogeochemistry in wetlands? In other words, starting with, you know, what are we measuring? Quite often we're not measuring what we think we are. What controls the availability, storage, and release? We've spent a lot of careers have been spent on this particular question. And then we're starting to see organic phosphorus, how much of it really is available and what do we know? And this is an area that's not as well known. And then what about phosphorus? Is it always a limiting element, or is it limiting, or when is it limiting? And then finally, assimilative capacity, something you may be interested with some management aspects. And then finally, talk about some what I call major gaps, which there are a lot of. Now, I'll start out by saying the ultimate limiting factor. So here you can see a quote from Isaac Asimov on his famous book. You know, Asimov wrote about many topics. One of my favorites growing up was reading Asimov. But it's interesting, in 1959, you know, he writes, life can multiply until all the phosphorus has gone, and then there is an inexorable halt, which nothing can prevent. And that sounds, you know, okay, well, we believe that, but is that really a reality? Well, in fact, he was thinking about this long before a lot of people were, even though it's the 12th most available element on the planet. We have to really ask the question, you know, where does it come from and how much do we have left? Well, this is a recent paper that came out from taking data from USGS and a number of international sources. And this particular figure shows you from Vaccari in 2009 something kind of interesting. If the size of these circles shows you in thousands of metric tons, you can see here that surprisingly to maybe to a number of people, Morocco has the most readily reserved phosphorus. Now, there's phosphorus all over the world, but try to mine it if it's only at one part per million. You can't do that. We're talking about mostly apatite, although in Russia and South Africa, we're talking about granitic phosphorus, which takes a lot of energy to get it out. So we're talking about, you know, phosphorus that was formed, of course, in high deposits, you know, millions of years ago. But if you look, here we see the size of these circles. The second one is China, and with about 4 million thousand metric tons. And here you can see the United States comes in actually fourth, and you can see here South Africa with, surprisingly, Jordan coming in fifth. Now, the squares below show you the rate at which it's being mined. Most of the world's residue reserves are being mined in China as their rapid growth is taking place, 50,000 metric tons per year. And you can see down here the United States is around 30. So when you look, it's kind of ironic. We talk about the oil problem and the Hubbert Peak and all these things and where the reserves are. Well, the United States is a little better off in terms of reserves compared to oil, but it's kind of interesting when you look, here you can see Morocco, Jordan over here. The Middle East, again, controls one of the most valuable resources. Since there's no carbon fixation going on in the world, no production without phosphorus. And you can see again where these are located, China, South Africa, which is parts have not been very stable for a while, and of course the U.S. Well, if you put that in some perspective, you can look at phosphate rock production in billions of metric tons, to make these numbers a little closer to some numbers on the y-axis. But look at the world production starting in their data from about 1900, and you can see in the green line, it's going up here, and it zigs and zags with the economy a bit, and agricultural production will follow this line very closely. Then there's a big dip here, and then you'll notice it's climbing again as China comes online and is really starting to produce this. But look at the U.S. production down here with the fourth largest reserves. We peaked actually at about 19 in the late in the 70s. We've had some zigzags here, but you'll notice it's on the downward decline. Our phosphate reserves are actually at the rate we're mining are on the way down. And you can notice down here this little red squiggly line, we're actually starting to import phosphate rock. This is phosphate rock. Obviously, phosphorus would be a portion of that. And what do? When we mine that, we take that rock and we make mostly phosphoric acid and super phosphoric acid, and it's used as feedstocks and fertilizers and feed supplements. That's what we do with most of it. And we export about 40% now of our phosphoric acid for sale. And the U.S. market's worth about $3.5 billion in 2008. But in 93, the farmer was paying $21 per ton. We were paying $21 per ton to buy this phosphate and fertilizer. And now we're paying $113 a ton. So the farming community has been really hit in the nose with the cost of this phosphorus. Now, this is one of the, to finish this part of the talk up, this is one of the interesting aspects because it's going to relate back to phosphorus and wetlands and what role they might play. But here is the years remaining of phosphorus reserve based on annual mining rates. And you can see the 1, 2, 3, 4 rankings of the amount of ranks. And Jordan would be in here as well. Actually, that number is wrong. It should be China should be 2. Jordan should be 5. But in case you are really interested in this rate, is kind of deceptive because in actuality, this green line tells you when you're looking at the total world consumption that in fact there's less than 100 years of readily reserves of phosphate rock left. And for the United States, it's actually 38 years. And so look at down in the number of these countries, we're talking 1 or 2 decades of reserves that we have left at the rate at which we're mining it. Doesn't mean that we couldn't pay more money and dig deeper, but this is the phosphate where you're paying $113. You want to pay $300, $400, $500. There's a limit of what you can pay. South Africa has a huge amount, and they're not mining very much, but again, the world average here is less than 100 years. People argue, well, it may be 150 or it may be 200, but it's pretty scary, especially for the U.S. with less than, say, 40 years. So that's sort of the phosphate story in the terms of this, and I think it's one of the really unstated stories that's really going on in terms of how we're going to survive the long-term agricultural production as the population grows with less and less available phosphorus. So we have a lot of phosphorus that we're putting on the landscape, so what do we know about phosphorus? What's our known or understanding? Well, we can say what's new or some new in the areas of research. First of all, most of the research has been done working on and studying and in the environment looking at things like phosphate. We know with our oxidized environment, we have the +5 valence state. We're mostly talking about that, but in fact, recent research has been looking at things like phosphonates and at different valence states of phosphorus. Almost everything, 99% of all the work has been done on this level of phosphate work, but there are work on that, including work on phosphine, which people said at one time didn't exist, and then it did exist in a small amount, and people are really starting, as the techniques become available, looking at various forms of phosphorus, both inorganic and organic. And I put this up because I think this is kind of an interesting As I said, I'm starting at a big scale. I went now even bigger than global almost. This is Pasek's and Loretta's 2005 paper. They have a more recent one in PNAS. This is from Astrobiology. And the thinking is that the prebiotic life on Earth, which is a reduced environment, could not have had phosphate as the form to carry on life. It must have had a reduced form. And in fact, from meteors and from the Earth's crust, you can see iron phosphide is Fe3P is the form that you find actually in meteors that hit in Antarctica. And this is slowly oxidized, but what's interesting, this experiment that they did, they went through and did a whole series of leachings and corrosion experiments and with acetic acid and dissolved water and all sorts of things to see if they could produce part of this primordial soup that would actually get us somewhere to start off to get phosphate. This is not, it's kinetically not possible to do that, but they're hypothesizing and they're showing with their experimental work that in fact you can produce some intermediates, and the first thing you produce here is a phosphonate, a plus three, and this that they would say that the early Earth, the early organisms, bacteria, used phosphonate. Some people were saying, well, you can't use phosphonate. Where would you find that? Well, you find it in reduced environments, wetlands, bottoms of oceans, lakes. Does that still exist in terms of utilization? Well, this, not to go through great detail of this, but basically there are some intermediate steps as this is oxidized through to finally produce things like pyrophosphate and the phosphate itself, and even triphosphate. So these intermediate steps were found during these experiments in the laboratory with actual meteorite material. And so there's a very good story going on in terms of how we started and got this phosphorus in our oxidized world. Well, can you use phosphonates? Well, it turns out, this is a paper that came out last week in Environmental Biology, and this is a really interesting series of findings, and it's very detailed, but I'll just give you sort of the bottom line. What it really shows is this red line here is phosphonate. There are two or three types of phosphonate, and the blue line is actually phosphorus, and it basically shows this is growth of bacteria that in fact these are growing better on the phosphonate addition than the phosphorus and or close to it. And this one of course is not quite the same. Here is just inorganic phosphorus being added. Over here as a control is a E. coli that actually has no gene to use phosphonate. The gene is missing, which is really cool because then they could start to get to the gene level. I'll get to that later in the talk. But here you can see it grows very well with just inorganic phosphorus, and it doesn't do anything with any of the phosphonate forms. But if you add phosphorus, inorganic phosphorus here, it starts to grow. So there are a number, and in fact the title of this is Widespread Phosphonate Utilization in Marine Bacteria. These probably exist in a number of wetland systems and estuarine systems that haven't been studied. And then finally, to show some other areas, this idea of phosphine from an Antarctic biosphere compared with other biospheres, some work from Zhao and group from China, just came out a more recent paper as well showing this. But we begin to see that there's a flux, even though it's nanograms, very low, we can see they're getting this originally from penguin colonies with iguano and so forth, where there's high levels of this. We see it in wastewater. But what is interesting is there's been some work out of LSU with Ron DeLon and his group, Bill Patrick's shop, you can see that they actually were the first ones to measure in Louisiana some low levels of phosphine. But there's actually some more recent measurements in Beijing and rice paddies and also in the mudflats. Huge levels may be produced under certain conditions. The gas, it's not going to be a major player, but it is a form of phosphorus that people are now taking a look at. And then here we can see something called marine polyphosphates. And the reason I'm bringing these up is these are all going to be brought back into my wetland story in just a moment. Here you can see a paper in 2008 from Diaz that came out. Is polyphosphate a major player in this geological phosphorus sequestration? Where do we get apatite? Why does the ocean floor, huge amount of it covered with apatite? How is this forming? How is this taking place? It was sort of an enigma. This paper suggests that polyphosphate, which is an unbranched polymer of orthophosphate with high energy phosphor anhydride bonds. Essentially, when you can measure this, and there hadn't been any techniques, there's some new techniques, x-ray, fluorescence, micrograph work, and fluorescence. Here is an estuarine bay area in Vancouver, and essentially you can see here both the apatite peaks and the polyphosphate peaks at about 50-50 in these bottom sediments of this estuarine area. But what I really want to point out from this paper is the fact that they point out that this diagenic transformation of polyphosphates to apatite, and they show the mechanism by which this may take place, that the apatite that's being formed at the bottoms of these estuarine and marine systems may very well be, in fact, they were able to demonstrate by doing some NMR work and so forth, that in fact you can go from polyphosphates and produce this calcium, this apatite. And so there's a mechanism under these conditions that in fact apatite is being produced. And they finally talk about this as the biological pump. You take dissolved inorganic low-level phosphorus in the marine estuarine system, they're picked up by plankton. But you'll notice this percentage number here, this is the percentage of polyphosphates that in fact are being carried forward in the system. And these polyphosphate granules eventually end up in this orthogenic, which is the apatite formed in place. And so this is a mechanism that is available, and I think first time we're really trying to understand or understanding this. So that's sort of some new things. And how does this wetlands, of course, the field of wetlands, the field of soil science, while we've done some amazing things, we're pretty far behind in terms of some of these thought processes and studies that are going on in some of the other fields. And my point is we need to draw on some of these, and we do. We might be doing it a little faster. So now let's go to what we know and then talk about wetlands. What are the environmental consequences of excessive P additions? Well, there are two classic experiments I'll show you very briefly. And one is we know, and this is the standard story, so I use this as a case example. This is Schindler's famous study, Lake 227 in Canada. Probably you all know about it, maybe you don't. This is actually a wonderful picture showing this lake where you got permission, this 5-hectare lake where they actually put a wall between the two branches of the lake. And they were able to fertilize one side and not the other and do these control ecosystem experiments for over 40 years. And this is an experiment that essentially was an N and P experiment to answer the question, what controls eutrophication? A lot of arguments, it's been settled, it's not been settled, it's nitrogen, it's phosphorus, it's both, it's only phosphorus in these systems. So Lake 227 has been fertilized for 40 years, and I want to show you just a couple of the findings from that 40-year synthesis, which is, this is the only study like this in the world. So you start out in the 70s, and I want to point out up here, they started this study in 1969, the N-to-P loading ratio, which relates to the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus by weight here, you can see 12-1 in this period of time, and then it's, after 1975, dropped to 5-1, and then after 1990, there is no nitrogen added to the system to test whether or not, in fact, what would happen to the lake dynamics and eutrophication if you took away all the nitrogen, and so on. So if you take a look at that, you will see that the total phosphorus levels here stay pretty much going up as you keep adding some here, but they stay within reason. But the total nitrogen goes up as it's being added and, of course, slowly decays. But the TN to TP ratio basically stays about the same. Kind of interesting. But this is sort of the proof in the pudding to finish up with this part. And this is, here again, the 12-1, the 5-1, and then 0, is that in the early part of this, you can see here's the biomass of all the algae growing on the surface and in the lake. And you can see the purple here, the cyanobacteria, but these are non-nitrogen fixing bacteria. The fixing bacteria labeled over here are the clear white area. And you can see as we drop the amount of nitrogen from 12-1 ratio to 5-1, the amount of nitrogen fixing bacteria pick up. And in fact, when we get over to 1990, you can see, in fact, it really picks up. So the point and the summary of this study is to stop eutrophication in these systems, you've got to stop the phosphorus input. It's not, in fact, You'd think this would have been settled. Nitrogen in this very remote system here, when it doesn't make any difference to the amount of nitrogen, the blue greens will fix the nitrogen, and it's phosphorus limited. And as you add more and more phosphorus and no nitrogen, you get blue greens, you get that horrible eutrophication in these systems. This is now taking place in the Baltics, taking place in lots of places in the world, in the estuaries. And Schindler points out, and this is a very nice article in PNAS, it's quite likely that these estuarine systems that we've been calling strictly nitrogen limited, we need to be looking at phosphorus, not this. And this dead zone in Louisiana, we've got to start looking at this role here, that this small short-term experiments that have been done on nutrient limitation probably are giving us false readings compared to these long-term studies. Now, so I'll finish with that and go into, those are lakes. So lakes, you add a certain amount of phosphorus with rainfall, and you add it, this is sort of a cartoon, you add a certain amount of runoff, and the lake, if it's turning over, will have a certain, reach a certain level of phosphorus, and there will be a certain buildup in the sediments. That's a lake. I want to now turn to the wetland story. Wetlands are different, and people don't think about them that way. And quite often, you just think about them, stuff being added. You get the rainfall distribution over here, and you get usually the phosphorus. My point is, it's added at the edge. I don't know any systems where the wetlands get the phosphorus added to the middle, unless it's a small constructed wetland where you bubble it through. And so this makes a big difference, because what we're going to have is one key word, gradient. You're going to create a gradient in the surface water if you add more, but even if you add a quarter or less, you still get a gradient because of the uptake. You get a gradient in the water, you get a gradient stored in the soil, and you will get a concentration that's proportional in the water to the amount in the soil. So now we need to look at wetlands in this gradient fashion. Here's the example I use. Here's the sugarcane farm and sugar mill in the former Everglades. Several hundred thousand hectares of sugarcane being grown. And here's work that I've worked on for about 15 years. Here is the Everglades agricultural area here, and here is the area where about 90 metric tons of phosphorus and nitrogen and other things are added along these three outflow systems here. And you'll notice this red isopleth here, this is 1,500 milligrams per kilogram of phosphorus. We've created a gradient going down the line. So there's the gradient that you would get. And what has it done? Here's the effect. Here you can see phosphorus, total phosphorus, unfiltered here, with numbers that go almost to 100, going down that gradient, and here you can see soluble reactive phosphorus, much less. And what do we have? Near the input of that, we have a complete conversion of that system. And I'll talk about this on and off with some other chemistry data. You can see it's all cattails and two other invasive species here, Pistia and water hyacinths. 4 to 8 kilometers away, we have sort of a mixed community, but still somewhat enriched, and then we see the interior with pretty much the base background levels. Now, to overcome this problem, a gradient problem, a lot of money, time, effort, and you've heard probably many talks, some of you have, on the Everglades. Here we see Lake Okeechobee, which is a eutrophic lake due to all the phosphate mining and ag up here. But here's that farm area, and the state of Florida has spent, in one case, over $700 million building stormwater treatment areas, which are really just wetland systems, and they have reduced the amount of phosphorus on farming, which is great, and they've rebuilt about 16,000 hectares of stormwater areas. Well, as of just over the last few years, if you look at the average of all of these systems, some working better than others, we're getting about 48 parts per billion or micrograms per liter coming out of those systems. Their systems are supposed to try to reach this magic 10 line, which is the standard set by EPA. So the farm community obviously is a bit upset. And the state, of course, is rightly upset because the standards haven't been met. But if you look from basically 1978 to 2000 up to 2005, here are the inputs going down that gradient. The gradient I'm talking about is water conservation area 1, 2, 3 in the park. Going down that line, phosphorus running in through these systems and flowing through down this way, you can see the inputs. Here's the 10 microgram per liter line are well in excess even with the stormwater treatment areas in place, although they're doing better, that's going down. The interior is just about reaching that, but not for the big hitted area. It's a little bit better in three, and the park is getting occasionally over 10, but not much. Most of the time, the interior is well below that. But the output from some of these systems that are hit heavily is still well above that. That's sort of the status of where we are. So those are my examples. So now let's go back and look at some of the interior understandings of phosphorus biogeochemistry to see whether we can make some improvements or what we know about it or where we are. So what's our understanding, or maybe what's my understanding, of phosphorus biogeochemistry in a sense of what we're measuring? And what forms or species of phosphorus are we typically measuring? Well, these are the typical usual suspects, the total phosphorus and the SRP and DOP and PO and FOP and particulate organic phosphorus and various other fractions, and there are books filled on how to fractionate these and filter these and measure these, and quite a bit of confusion as to quite often what's measured. But is this enough or is it appropriate? Well, maybe for some of the big questions, it is. Now, there was a meeting last night on the CIRA 17. I got in late. I couldn't attend that. But there was a meeting, and I'm on that web list, and there are probably a number of people in the room who are well familiar with the CIRA 17 guidelines to try to come up with standards for measuring phosphorus. These are the ones you could go through. Also, to try to come up with a phosphorus index to try to come up to predict how much phosphorus would run off the agricultural lands, trying to come up with a threshold, trying to come up with ways to reduce that non-point source. But there are a lot of forms that are not really being studied that carefully when you just look at it in that fashion. And there are forms of insoluble reactive phosphorus. And there are lots of these inorganic things that we mentioned, like on the marine systems, the pyrophosphates, the polyphosphates, and then the organic phosphorus like the inositol phosphates and the phosphonates and the sugars and so on. These are important sources possibly for energy for some of the bacteria. And then, of course, there are the colloids and the things that are absorbed. So we'll go through a few of those. And we're interested in these organic phosphorus compounds as well because they can be mineralized. They may be released from sediments, and they may be a form of available phosphorus in the future for specific organisms. Now, the distribution of organic phosphorus fractions in soils, you can see compared to a number of other ones in terms of monoesters, that's the dominant form of these organic P fractions, work from Imagine in 1996. And we're primarily talking about inositol phosphates here. So quite a different distribution of organic phosphorus fractions in soils versus, say, bacteria. And of course, we've got a lot of these compounds then that we have to deal with in various forms. And one of the early work that's been done, there have been some earlier work, but one related to wetlands, is Turner's work, who has looked at a lot of different systems, and borrowed a slide from him on this. And you can see here, you can see soil phosphorus composition. And using a technique of P31 NMR to look at this, and you can see, here's a soil from a tundra soil, and he's using this as an example to show you that in a tundra type wetland soil, you can see there are things like phosphonates, and you can get the typical inorganic phosphorus, but there are orthophosphorus, phospholipids, DNA, phosphate end groups, pyrophosphates, and mid-chain polyphosphates. There's quite an array that can now be identified in these systems. This is a powerful tool and powerful information. And he also shows that you can have differences related to this with climates and soils. Taking the tundra one down here with all the forms we saw, here you can see a pasture that has been, obviously, the vegetation has been changed quite a bit. It's being pastured. A lot of those other forms are disappeared. You get to the arable lands in Idaho, they're only inorganic phosphates. Taking that concept, we did some work in our group, and here you can see Barra Farms in North Carolina, and here we have, it's about a 3,000 acre farm and ag fields with soybeans and corn. This was part of a restoration, 600 acre restoration took place by the state, and so we've been following the restored sites. Here is a natural area, bay forest that had been on the side, and here is a Pocosin. These are the wetlands. This was all former wetland converted to agriculture. And here, a paper we just published with P.B. Sundarishwar, myself, and a few others, you can see the ag land is dominated by inorganic phosphates. And then if you look at the five-year-old restored wetland, we're starting to get a picture that this might be a way to indicate how well the restoration's taking place and how the complexity is coming back in terms of the bacteria. You can see here the restored, we're getting phosphonate peaks and phosphodiesters here. And after 8 years, we're starting to pick up actually some polyphosphates. Here is one of those sites near there that is actually a forest that was cut 50 years hence, and it's got even a bigger peaks and some of the other stuff, and here is the natural system. So we will see that after 5, 8, 10 years, we're getting some restoration. Another figure from that paper, that's this exact data right here. You can see the phosphates going down from agriculture, 5 years, 8 years, and you can see the 50-year cut and so on, and you can see the monoesters decreasing as well and the polyphosphates picking up. But on the right-hand side, I want to point out, this is actually prairie potholes in the Midwest. We got an ag system dominated by inorganics and some monoesters, but then as you get a 16-year restoration and a natural, we begin to see some of these other. So it's happening in these restored systems, and this is a good indicator of how well and how fast this is happening. So now we can look at what's controlling phosphorus release and storage and so forth, and this is a very complicated diagram. It's sort of the rest of the talk. We have inflows, we have water column phosphorus, and we have outflows, but we have a number of things that can happen to that phosphorus. It can go into this series of boxes, become organic, become refractory, and so on, and eventually long-term storage. But what's controlling the dynamics is really taking place here, algae, bacteria, and then sorption and desorption, aluminum, iron controls. And what's really critical to this is a series of what Bill Patrick worked on, and a number of his students, like Ramesh Reddy, the electron acceptors, the alternate electron acceptors, and the microbial decomposition diagenesis that will be controlling the availability of phosphorus. We'll go through that, and a little bit of that anyways. And here we can see phosphine gas being produced and so on. And of course, it's all being affected by not only the climate, but also other nutrients. So these are the basic, to boil it down, we're talking about pH controls, adsorption and desorption, microbial absorption and release, uptake, sedimentation, and of course, even the litter, which people don't consider as a compartment, usually as much, but it should be looked at because it's where a lot of the activity is going. So if we look at some of the classic phosphorus research, you can go back and Bill Patrick was working in many areas, and this was one. Here's a paper that he did an original version of this in 68, but published this in 73. Here we see a simply probably well-known graph showing pH here increasing, going from 5 to 8, and we see a redox, soil redox, going from 300 to minus 250, and what we see right away is the amount of phosphorus released in the solution goes up under low pH and reduced conditions, and this some of the first evidence to show that in these wetland soils or soils that are reduced, like paddy soils, you'd get this release. While I was working at that time, started to work in the early 70s in wetlands. We were adding wastewater to Houghton Lake, Michigan, and we began to notice this moving phosphorus front seasonally. And the question was why? So you start digging into the literature, and you get into the literature, and you start finding some keynote papers, like Bill's paper, with Caleb basically looking at phosphorus release and sorption by soils and sediments. And this is just a quick summary of some of the findings, and what they're finding is here you can see the difference between the reduced and the oxidized, and you're finding essentially that under certain conditions here you get phosphorus in solution being released under low levels, you're getting a release on the reduced conditions, and what's surprising here is they're pointing out that even, which was against the traditional dogma, that under reduced conditions you got additional sorption, this line here being more sorption, less release, under reduced conditions. And this was to do with the idea, they said, well, it's due to the changes from ferric to ferrous and this anhydrous iron, and it's basically has more surface, and so therefore you can get more sorption even under these reduced conditions if you have enough of this reduced iron. Recent work in Israel has basically pointed out that this may not totally be true. It may be that there's precipitation going on, and really what you should be looking at, which we'll get into, is looking at the equilibrium phosphorus concentration, not so much the sorption maximum. But this was classic work that got myself thinking and other people thinking about this, and I started to look at a number of wetlands, and here you can see the equilibrium concentration from a classic sorption isotherms, and you can see the amount of phosphorus adsorbed, and you can see Pocosins in North Carolina are low, mineral swamps in Maryland and New Jersey are high, the Everglades are here, and some intermediate ones at Houghton Lake, what I was working on. So this gave us quite a range, that some would be higher, some would be lower in terms of their absorption capacity. And in fact, I related this to the, using Bill's idea and some others, that this might be related to this oxalate aluminum extraction and iron. And I basically, it could be, here I'm plotting the aluminum, oxalate extractable aluminum, that amorphous kind, versus P-sorb index. And you can see bogs and fens sit down here in the U.S. and the mineral swamps up here. And there's a nice relationship. You could predict the sorption capacity from the amorphous aluminum. Well, you could actually use iron too. In fact, Ramesh Reddy has shown that you can use both depending on the soils, and this is a sorption maximum, showing that as you have more of this, you would get more sorption maxima. But there are a number of people who argue that in fact, you really shouldn't be looking at the sorption maxima. You should be looking at the equilibrium concentration. That's the balance between what's in the soil and what would go into solution. If you have more in the soil and less coming in the solution, it will go the other way. It will actually leave. The scale isn't quite right here on this, but basically the idea is on this phosphorus being added much higher levels here, going down this gradient, you can see that the EPCO is much higher where it's being added than down here. In other words, there's lower pore water phosphorus concentration here, and if you added it, you would have any levels, you would have more uptake down at this end, less potential at this end. Now, there are abiotic processes we're interested in, things like the organic process of organic P, and these are also been looked at, but not very often in wetlands. Here's some work that's been done by Seeley in Italy, and you can see here in hexetol phosphate, the organic form, and you can see clays and so on being looked at here for texture. This is the adsorbed amount. This is the equilibrium point, and you can see here, sand very low for absorbing these organic forms of P, this organic form. And then you can see sandy clays, and you, of course, clays being the highest. And then if you add inorganic phosphorus, you find out actually the organic's more bound than the inorganic phosphorus, which is kind of interesting. And in fact, even more so than the ATP. So that's sort of the absorption-desorption picture very quickly. And now we can also look at where long-term phosphorus is stored. Here's an early study done in the 90s by Ramesh Reddy in the Everglades looking at carbon and phosphorus sequestration. And we see here's the amount of carbon accretion going on. And here is the increase in carbon. And here's the phosphorus accretion here. And here's in grams per meter squared per year. And you can see there's a nice relationship. As the plants are producing more carbon and fixing it, you store more. You get more accretion going on because, of course, you're building up more organic soil. And I basically, looking at those same areas, you can see this is the amount of phosphorus. This is the total amount of phosphorus along a gradient where you have this 80 to 100 metric tons of phosphorus going in at about 100 micrograms per liter. And you can see there's more towards the edge and there's less phosphorus in the litter, in the soil, I should say, and goes further down into that gradient I talked about earlier. And most of that phosphorus is in the organic matter, which is the red and blues, the humics and the fulvics, and sort of the refractory form. And the microbial component is this little tiny component here, which makes up this light blue. But it's a larger component than people think. Not much iron, not much aluminum there, but there is a fair amount of calcium, which is the red, because the Everglades is alkaline. And in fact, if you look at the amount, here's the average accretion rate in grams per year. The total is about 0.5 for all this. You look across that, and that's about what you're going to get in the Everglades. 0.5 is a reasonable number. In the enriched areas, in the unenriched areas, about 0.1. But there are various forms. This is a modified Headley fractionation, and you can see that in fact the refractory terms, in other words, what's long-term storage here, it's mostly in these inorganic forms, and you can see well over 50%, in fact 60% are in this form, even a large amount of that in the unenriched area, not much in the iron and aluminum, more in the calcium. And if you look down here in the labile, which is going to be available for short-term storage, you can see what's interesting is that the microbial biomass has about 13% proportionally in the enriched area, but up to 35% they're controlling in the unenriched area. They're actually using and cycling and making available this phosphorus. Now, there are other ions that make play a role in this, and this we can't talk about phosphorus without talking about not only just nitrogen but also and carbon, but also here's sulfur. Here you can see Caracco's work in South America, that if you had a high sulfur system, the phosphorus to carbon molar ratio is going to go way up. It's going to, as sulfate can bind to some of those sites, and also it's reduced. And it has to do with the sulfur cycle, which we'll go into in a minute. But you can see there's quite a difference between high sulfur sites like marine systems or low sulfur systems. And here is some work from Roden and Edmonds in 1977. And you can see that, in fact, where you have millimoles of released phosphorus with carbon oxidized, you can see sulfates as the alternate electron acceptor here. You can see a lot of carbons being burned up as well, but a lot of phosphorus is being released. Much more with the sulfate here, and much more in the marine system, which has sulfates, than in the freshwater system. In fact, Roden put out this, and Edmonds put out this very nice diagram, which I won't go through in great detail, but the point is, you've got your iron direct reductions, you've got your sulfate-reducing bacteria reductions, you've got things like vivianite down here, which, and productions of things like iron sulfide. All of these interact to end up, when this reduction takes place, to release phosphates. Or you form iron sulfides down here in several ways. Or you basically, this can be oxidized or reduced, and you basically end up releasing again phosphates. So there are many mechanisms, which I don't have time to go through, but the point is sulfur, iron, carbon all play a key role in the release of this material. So is organic phosphorus available or found? Well, we know, here's a work that I did in the early 80s or mid-80s. This is a picture of radioactive phosphorus uptake in the Houghton Lake Marsh, and this is the time since start here in the number of hours. So we're talking about a week to a few days here. And you can see that in the sediments and the bacteria, they take up, this is a log scale, so you've got 10 up to 780,000. All this material, when you add radioactive phosphorus, goes into the sediment bacteria group immediately. The plants are very low down here, and after a week, two, they have to break very little of this, and the water, of course, loses its amount. So the bacteria and the sediments are taking this up, fine particles, almost immediately. The microbes, of course, the amount that they take up is very much related on EH and pH, and here's some work from McClatchy and Reddy, and you can see when oxygen is present, they take up the most, but when they have to use nitrate as an alternate electron acceptor, that goes less, sulfate and so on, it costs more, and they take up and store less P. There are very few studies to talk about mineralization of organic P, and this is one from one of my former students, Scott Bridgham. He looked at bogs and fens, and you can see here essentially both P mineralization actually surprisingly is higher under the anaerobic conditions for all sites, but most of this, the rates are much higher in the bogs and fens than they are in the other tamarack meadows and swamps. The amount being released under anaerobic conditions has to do, again, with some of the iron and the availability of the carbon and the microbes. We also know that alkaline phosphatase plays a role, and in fact, when you add phosphorus, this is this gradient again, where in the Everglades, where you add phosphorus, fairly high levels coming in here, and it decreases to background levels as you go up, that this phosphatase will increase, meaning that the organic phosphorus that's there, and there's not much inorganic phosphorus, is going to be utilized if we can break it down, and that's the case, and that's what Ramesh Reddy has shown along a series of gradients, and here's a study showing phosphatase activity and organic P mineralization, and you can see as the activity goes up, the P mineralization goes up, very nice relationship. So bacteria and root cells and roots produce this phosphatase, as do fungi and other organisms to increase this. So now we'll finish up with something, that a new thing that we're working on, which is what I call differential nutrient limitation. Is phosphorus always limiting? What's limiting? What's this story of N and P limitation? Are autotrophs and heterotrophs limited by the same nutrient, nitrogen, phosphorus, in low nutrient environments? Well, the first work in wetlands was done with P.V. Sundarishivar, who was a postdoc in my shop. And essentially, this was a salt marsh, and there are various treatments looking with nitrogen, carbon, and phosphorus. I'll go through this. Here you can see we measured, or he measured phosphatase activity and production and bacterial numbers and thymidine incorporation to try to look at who's taking up the phosphorus and which is controlling nitrogen or phosphorus on which trophic level. And published in Science, and you can see here the response of the salt marsh to N and P fertilization. Right away, carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, and phosphorus, you can see the plants are essentially getting more production here with nitrogen and nitrogen and phosphorus. But primarily nitrogen is the one that pushes that. Whereas you look down here, bacteria, you don't get response of nitrogen. You get responses of phosphorus or nitrogen and phosphorus. If you look at the effects of nutrients and carbon treatment, which is glucose in this case, on thymidine incorporation, and we can see here basically is carbon having a role in terms of this uptake by this. You can see that essentially it is phosphorus or N and P that is increasing the amount of uptake by these bacteria. And this PP column is a phosphonate that was actually added, another form of phosphorus, see if they could use it. Back to our phosphonate story. And so again, you can see that the microbes apparently in the estuary, in the salt marsh, is limited by phosphorus, whereas the other one, the plants are limited by nitrogen. And here you can see where we add glucose, we get stimulation again if you add carbon. So they're secondarily limited by carbon availability. And this is also turns out that phosphorus is going to affect denitrification rates and nitrogen fixation rates. And here's a control, and here's the addition of phosphorus. And it actually, the addition of phosphorus actually decreases denitrification rates, the N2O production, and actually has a negative effect on that particular aspect. And it's not offset by the fixation rate. So what we, and what PV has been able to show, and we've got a new NSF grant working on this in some different systems, is that it's very likely in these low nutrient systems that N and P concepts are going to have to be rethought, and the phosphorus limitation or nitrogen limitation are going to have to be rethought, and it may have a role in wetlands and ag systems as well. So can we quantify, the last thing I did put together here is, can we quantify now, maybe bring it back to a larger scale, phosphorus assimilative capacity and phosphorus storage? Well, we know if we add phosphorus, we can get an increase in output, but we also can get, this is below the line is a sink, above it's a source. This is hundreds of wetlands. Paper I published with one of my grad students, and here, essentially you see as we add more and more phosphorus to these wetlands, you get more and more phosphorus uptake, but you also get more output. What we began to notice when we did this on a loading rate is if you put 150 some wetlands in here and you look at the loading rate, this is a mass loading rate going from 0.01 up to 1,000. Some of these are constructed wetlands, some of these are natural. You can see the outflow is that there is a change point. There is an amount by which you can add a fair amount of phosphorus to these systems, and you get virtually no change in the output. And then there is this change point, and essentially you get a rapid increase of this. And we tested this along that gradient again in the Everglades to see whether we could determine a similar capacity for the Everglades. And here we've scaled it down because the loading rates are much lower, from 0.01 to 5. Same idea, and you can see here this line going in, this yellow line is a probability Bayesian line, and essentially what's the probability of you exceeding this threshold, and you can see up to about somewhere between 0.5 and 1 grams that in fact you don't really exceed that, and then at that point all hell breaks loose and you have about a 95% probability of exceeding the assimilative capacity of that system. You can think of it as a TMDL almost in a sense, and from that we basically found that, in fact, if you go down that gradient again, here's the uptake rate, here's the decrease in phosphorus concentration, here's that line right here at about 1 gram, and you'll notice that there's some error bars here which run from about 0.5 to about 1.4, so it's not just a straight line. It will depend on your system, but this is the range. You cannot exceed that particular range without effects, and the effects up here are high enrichment, changes of species, and so on. So from that, we produce what I call the 1 gram rule. Phosphorus loading into freshwater wetlands above 1 gram will result in a significant increase in community changes and P concentration outputs once short-term upstake processes are saturated. It has to be tested. The Everglades are probably closer to 0.5, but this has been tested in Europe and other places. It seems to work pretty well. You can think of it as a wetland TMDL. One difficulty with finishing up with this, adding phosphorus to this, here's some studies from Reddy, and this shows you water column phosphorus time and years. When you add a lot of phosphorus to wetlands, there's what we call this memory. And if you add a lot of this to the system, or you reflood a system, it was an ag field, and put it in there, a lot of that phosphorus is still there. The consequences of that is it's going to take a number of months, maybe several years, this is the phosphorus flux out of the soil for that phosphorus because of this EPCO concentration equilibrium I talked about. You got all this phosphorus stored, you add a lower level of clean water, it's going to go out into the water column, so you're still going to have dramatic effects on the communities and the plants above due to this flux. We tested this in the Everglades, and you can see this result. Here's the most enriched site, here's the medium site, and here's the background site, which is 8 to 10 kilometers in, and you can see the amount of phosphorus is much different. If you add, say, 35 parts per thousand, 35 parts per billion, you can see we can drop that curve down. And what we see here is the unenriched site versus the enriched site. You can see as we go from background here to the adding of 10 plus background plus 35, if you add pristine clean water to the Everglades due to the amount that was already added there, you're going to get this flux rate out of the soil for a period of 2 to 3 to 4 or longer, depending on the amount, of years. And so it's this residual memory that's going to be important. So let's finish up with what are some of the major gaps in future research needs. Well, I've covered a lot, but let's talk about the major unresolved questions. What happens when the supply of phosphorus runs out? Can we recycle? Can we conserve? We obviously can't get it back out once it's in the bottoms of the lakes or runs into the ocean. Can we take it out of waste treatment plants? We should be able to do this. We precipitate a lot of it. Can we control losses from the agricultural landscape? We're working on it. Can we use buffers or treatment cells to remove and store the phosphorus? Maybe later mine it, but essentially we cannot afford to keep losing this finite resource, or we're going to not pay a hefty price, to say the least, besides the pollution. What role do the microbes play? We don't know hardly anything about this. We are really in sort of a naive world. We're just starting to now look at the gene components of that and the roles that's taking place of the interactions of phosphorus and carbon and the sulfur cycle. Can we genetically modify plants to require less uptake and maximize P uptake efficiency? Will differential nutrient limitation play a role? It is a new paradigm for wetland science, I think, and for probably biogeochemistry in general. And then how can we get to recognize the role of other phosphorus compounds in some of the studies, the phosphites, the phosphonates, the poly-P? These are going to be important players. Well, this is the future. This is a blast. This is some of my graduate students, published a paper in PNAS. He shows me all of these organisms, and it's way beyond where my expertise lies. But this is the future, what people are looking at, of what is controlling both plants, microbes, in terms of these nutrients. And from this information, you can study the plant communities, but you can also look at the microbial community changes related to all of these ions, including phosphorus, and how land use affects not only the chemicals here, but how it affects the communities. But the real future for a lot of this is going to rely on this little diagram, for example, back from Martinez. Here you can see a complete sequence of the genes that, in this blue, dark blue, is the part of the genome that basically allows for the utilization of phosphonate. You'll notice this E. coli is missing this. We are now able to create and add these genes components to enhance and use other forms or to stop the use of forms. This is going to be some of the future. So, P is the ultimate factor. We've got to look at multiple species. We know some of this basic chemistry. I won't go through all of that. We've talked about the storage, the long-term storage, and the fact that freshwater wetlands are often P limited, but maybe estuarine systems are as well in the soils. We're going to be studying these multiple cycles. We have to take a look at that in great detail. I think we've created sort of a TMDL for wetlands, and this PAC can be looked at. We can maximize some of that storage. It's not the same. Maximum storage in constructed wetlands is not just the PAC, because we don't care if we change the community. And then finally, we'll be looking at the molecular microbial research and genomics in the future. I think that'll be the key. So I'll stop with that. I'm the cat, you're the dogs.
Are there questions for Kurt?
You're overwhelmed. Yes?
Yeah, I was wondering when you showed the graph for the FMA, we know they want to achieve 10 micrograms per liter.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, do you think it's achievable? And how does it relate to your lower body of 1 gram, which is
It's going to take an awful lot of land to get to 10 micrograms per liter. The average out of most wetlands is about 20. Obviously, the Everglades can do it because you get 10 at the end, but it would take a tremendous amount of land to do that. I'd argue from the early 90s that the 16,000 hectares were about half of what they needed. There's work underway to actually double the size of the STAs. That may help. Of course, reducing more phosphorus on the ag land will help, but it's a very difficult problem. Those stormwater treatment areas are not reaching 10. There are a few of them, but most of them are not. And so basically they're in violation. EPA has a standard, state has a standard. They're all in violation of that standard. You can argue it's the farmers, you can argue it's the South Florida Water Management District, but 48 is about what you're getting. So I think the 1 gram rule, back to that, if you're adding all the STAs that are close to working, that you're getting around 17 to 20, they're loading at 1 gram or less, 1.1, 1.2. So in actuality, if the STAs are not overloaded, all the ones that are putting out 100 and 80 and 90, they're overloaded 1.9, 2.3, 3.2. They're overloaded for their capacity. So that PAC thing works very well.
Yeah. You said for the phosphorus coming off ag land, you'd like to have a buffer or a treatment cell to, I guess, store the phosphorus. What's your thoughts on how that would be stored and how that would cure the problem? I mean, are you looking for ways to get the stuff back onto the land or just store it in vegetation, or what's your thinking?
Well, I think the easiest ones they've been doing is to basically try to find, it's not buffers along the edge of just the rivers. I think that's, in Europe, they've been showing very careful studies that, and quite often in a lot of these big ag fields, there may be some depression areas in the field. I know a lot of our fields in some of the places, they've laser leveled them to nothing, but a lot of fields still have these dips. And those are the areas where you may actually route water through and then out of the system and use that to store the phosphorus in the mineral soil, for example. If you have to actually construct something there and actually build a wetland, then you may have the possibility of removing phosphorus and putting it back on the ag land. Because I think there, that's all you would do, is you'd recycle it. It's not a manure in a sense, it's a constructed wetland soil that you could put back on the land, because they will eventually fill up and build up, and then you could take that and put it back on the system. So that would be my two answers. One, I think we can create them in certain places where there'll be long-term storage, and other ones, if they get too overloaded, we dig them out and start them over again. And they're doing some of this in Europe, where they're actually putting some of these in various spots, like a checkerboard on the landscape. They put a lot of them near rivers, and those turned out to be, you know, along the edge of the streams. And a lot of those, the space is like, you know, say 40 feet. Well, it turns out the big storm comes and whoosh, it goes by the 40 feet so fast into the stream. You say, well, We got most of the low storms, we didn't get the high three storms. Well, the high three storms put everything out into the stream. So there has to be some different configurations on how to do that.
I have one question, Kurt. Clearly organic phosphorus forms are important parts of the total phosphorus pool, and I'm wondering if you thought at all about how the proportion of phosphorus in organic pools affects this memory lag that you mentioned when you're trying to recover a system. Is a system with a lot of organic P versus inorganic going to have a longer memory than
yeah. Oh, I think so. I think the looking at the few restored ones we have, you know, I say we've got some that are 3, 5, 8, and now 16 years. The complexity of that the turnover and the efficiency and retention of the phosphorus in those systems is so much better with the organic P and the slower release and the availability. I think you also the microbial communities that are there. We're just starting to look at that actually control that. May very well result in much less phosphorus leaving the systems. In fact, you find a lot of those, like Pocosins and a lot of those wetlands, very little phosphorus, as low as possible, leaves those particular systems. It's held in those. If you get into things like Mount Esters and some of those other ones, they don't break down very readily. But they are available under conditions. The other thing, polyphosphate is used and stored by microorganisms, and under stress conditions or under low phosphorus conditions, it can be utilized. But it also is a really interesting series of molecules that can be used by the organisms under, you know, oxidation reduction conditions, and when they're under stress, they use that. So it's really a very complicated story. Well, first of all, they can store a lot more. For example, they can over a period of time. And secondly, the microbes themselves, they can utilize some different forms of phosphorus than some of the plants can. Now, they, of course, the roots and the mycorrhizae have a very good chance of picking up, you know, a whole long-term storage amount of that material. But what is interesting, I think, I don't think it's just a different amount. I also think the other thing is the time sequence, I think, what I'm trying to get to. In other words, the nutrient limitation is never always phosphorus or always nitrogen. I'm trying to get this out right. And so there may be a short period of time. In fact, we're looking at it right now to see if this is a seasonal effect. We're actually looking at all four seasons. This was just a one-time analysis. And it may very well be that there's a short period of time where the organisms take up the phosphorus quickly or nitrogen, and then they have what they need. And so it may be a differential nutrient limitation over time. And so when you go out and just take this one-time measurement, you may be getting a sort of a false picture. But clearly the times we took those, there was a period where we got no responses. You saw the thymidine uptake. They just simply were no responses to nitrogen. And of course there are, and then in some systems, there are those nitrogen fixation organisms. They don't need any. I don't know if that helps, but 2 years from now when we finish this thing, I'll give you a better answer maybe.
I don't go anywhere, Kurt. I'd like to invite Dr. Patrick up to give you a gift in honor of your lecture.
Kurt, it's wonderful for me to be able to present this plaque to you, and you've been a special friend for so many years.
Thank you, Kurt.
And when I found out that you were going to be the speaker, it was accidental, but I knew I had to come.
Well, I'm glad you did. We can really appreciate in the society people like Ruth and Bill and what they've done and contributed.
And I really enjoyed his first slide. I understood that one. I look at it every day, many times. And thank you. And
well, thanks for coming.
I hope we'll see other nice, fine speakers at Patrick Lectures. I think y'all probably are going to start charging me dues because I've been to so many of these things as we tried to get this Patrick Lecture going. Thank you, Kurt.
Well, thank you.